This is the October 1st, 2015 climate change law class, and we are wrapping up international climate change law. As always, a very brief review and hopefully some structure. I find myself looking back and finding these discussions we've had about multiple layers of treaties and meetings turning into porridge in my head. So if I could, I'd like to sort of block out as a review exactly which agreements lay out which terms and how they define what we're focused on, which in particular is the Durban platform, the Doha principles, and ultimately the road to Paris. So some of this will be deeply familiar to you, I hope, beginning with the oldest, but the one that sets sort of the highest abstracted goal, Bali. The Bali action plan has a very simple takeaway. Namely, it's like the UNFCCC that set a framework for future negotiations and a specific deadline for reaching an agreement. The Bali deadline was 2009, but that same rolling deadline principle has now been invoked, as we'll discuss in a minute, to set our current 2015 deadline in Paris. The four main goals identified in the Bali Action Plan, which still are the goals of subsequent negotiations, are 1, adaptation, 2, finance, financial assistance and transfer mechanisms, 3, technology transfer, which, as we've mentioned in passing, raises a rat's nest of intellectual property protection issues, but nonetheless is fundamentally important for actually changing emission profiles. And last, capacity building, increasing the ability of a society to be resilient in the face of climate disasters. So that's Bali, and it's sort of the DNA that carries through to the subsequent negotiations. Next up, the one we talked about most last time was the Copenhagen Accords. And I hopefully injected some fresh perspective for many of you who may have heard that Copenhagen was a disaster and a waste of time and did more damage than good based on the expectations it frustrated. The bottom line is that Copenhagen made some very substantial achievements despite the fact it never became Kyoto 2. It never became another extended binding emissions framework. One, it established a bottom-up framework approach. That's an enormously important conceptual shift. Previously, all the parties in the UNFCCC were striving for emission top-down targets. Instead, bottom-up allows each nation to put on the table its own particular recipe on how it's going to reduce its greenhouse gas impacts. So, as a result, it's perfectly acceptable for Brazil to be put on deforestation remediation as an alternative to actually reducing their emissions. Perfectly acceptable to use biofuels instead of having reductions in their industrial facility. That flexibility created a much greater opportunity for developing nations to be more willing to participate and move away from the two-track common but differentiated framework that had been established in the UNFCCC originally. That bottom-up framework resulted in a different sets of obligations that were relatively soft for developing versus developed nations. The key thing for developing nations is that they were obligated to come up with nationally appropriate mitigation actions, NAMAs. And that's one of those acronyms that's going to keep popping up at us. The idea for NAMAs for developing countries under Copenhagen was essentially they get split. If they are using international funds for their NAMA, they have to go through a fairly rigorous registration process with the UNFCCC Secretariat for Climate Change. And they also have to go through an external monitoring, reporting, and verification framework. If, however, they choose to pass on the cash on the table and just do it on their own internally, they're entitled to autonomy and sovereignty, and they can do their own monitoring, reporting, and verification. And the reporting obligations are much less rigorous. They only have to report biannually. So it gives a little bit more flexibility to developing nations to put on the table what they want to do and how to prove they're doing what they say. But notice for both developed nations have a more rigorous framework. They don't have this option of this sort of soft verification. The bottom line, though, is that for both developing and developed nations, the key takeaway from Copenhagen is it's voluntary. No binding commitments, period. That was a a walk away from the Kyoto principles in that instead it's this bottom-up's meant to encourage and push rather than the top-down thou shalt do it. The other key thing about Copenhagen is money. As part of that lifting from below and voluntary approach, the carrot was essentially twofold: $30 billion in fast start money. More importantly, a commitment to raise $100 billion by the year 2020. Lots of caveats. The $100 billion, there's disagreement as to where it's coming from. Is it going to be commitments by nations, or is it going to be also raised from businesses? Lots of disagreement over how there will be governance of that money. The developing nations are frustrated that pre-existing funds tended to be very much controlled by the people giving the money. They want to say where it goes since they're receiving the money. And there's a lot of concern about making sure that there's a greater transparency and clarity about how financing is selected. So that's sort of the intellectual kernel of the Copenhagen Accords that we need to take away. A lot of the other things are fascinating, but as we get closer to Paris, they recede into historical significance. What does that mean in terms of actual legal outcome of Copenhagen Accord? Remember, it got the cold shoulder. Basically, most nations said that they were not going to accede to the Copenhagen Accords. Instead, there was a consensus that they were simply going to take notice, quote unquote. And as a result, the Copenhagen Accords were viewed essentially as, from an international legal perspective, relatively, trying to think of the right word for it, lacking enough consensus to have any kind of legal effect. What has happened and what has not gotten attention is that slowly over time, there's been a building acceptance of the Copenhagen Accords nation by nation over time. So currently we're up to 141 signatories to the Accords who have lodged diplomatic instruments saying that they will abide by the Accords. All of those make commitments in terms of what they're going to do to reduce their emissions, but they tend to be individualistic and they tend to be couched in conditional language. Exceptions: Russia has not signed to the Copenhagen Accords, last I checked. Others have conditions built in which may give them an opt-out if those conditions don't occur. Most of those conditions are built into acceptance of a binding international framework. So that is Bali, that is Copenhagen. Now we're getting to after Copenhagen. And the starting point for that is Cancun in 2010. There was much excitement here in downtown Houston, where we were trying to get together groups to fly down because it was right in our backyard. And by gosh, Houston and the energy economy had a big part to play in that discussion. Bottom line is that Cancun, like Copenhagen, resulted in soft imperatives but no legal bite in terms of binding commitments. Its major accomplishment was that it moved the negotiation framework away from a consensus approach, where everyone had to lay hands on the agreement and say, we agree. And instead, now it's more one of joint acceptance, where you can essentially override objecting nations and still reach a binding agreement for a larger group. That avoids the car wreck that was in Copenhagen, where a group of five nations basically spiked acceptance of the overall agreement from the get-go. With that new approval mechanism in place, the prospects of a Paris Accord look much more promising in subsequent agreements. What did Cancun actually agree to? Well, you're going to notice a theme for all the things we're going to talk about today. One, they bought into and endorsed the Bali Action Principles. They also confirmed the target that the Bali Principles laid out, which the Copenhagen Accords also emphasized, but essentially made a firmer commitment to a 2 degrees Celsius target to keep temperatures from rising above 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperature averages. It also, though, set up a framework to begin pushing that metric down to 1.5 degrees centigrade. So again, no binding commitment. That essentially they set the target, they set the framework, they line out the roadmap for further negotiations, but essentially it formalized some of the agreements of the Copenhagen Accords. That then brings us up to Durban in 2011. And Durban, by that point, people had kind of gotten the message. The optimism of Copenhagen had faded to a rather resigned air that they were going to keep kicking the can down the road a short distance, but still make progress. The participation of heads of state, much lower. President Obama was not flying to Durban for discussions on this one. So as a result, the Durban package, in a quiet way, made some significant strides that were not possible in Cancun. Number one, it set a deadline. And this is the deadline that's driving this class and a lot of our discussion. Durban specifically said 2015 was the year that you were going to have a binding agreement to deal with climate change. Essentially, it was an agreement to reach an agreement, but it's one that has a specific deadline. The other thing Durban did was it explicitly walked away from the two-track model of the UNFCCC in Kyoto, essentially saying developing nations share responsibility for taking steps to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and reducing climate change impacts. They're still common but differentiated, but that common but differentiated, that is so hard to say multiple times, is softened so that it doesn't turn into essentially an exit ramp for developing nations to do nothing. It also included, expressed in the Durban package, an on-ramp for any nations that wanted to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol. But as we'll talk about in a minute, the second commitment period did not have any new takers, so that was important that they reached the agreement. It didn't actually have some real-world effects. Other things about it to keep in mind, once again, the Bali Action Principles were expressly affirmed. So keep in mind those big four, adaptation, technology transfer, finance, and capacity building. And they also expressly affirmed the 2 degrees Celsius finish line. But it also expressly said and set up a process to study and put into a report lowering it to 1.5 degrees centigrade. So that led for a couple of legal consequences. Again, most of this under the surface. One, it set up a transition to Kyoto's second commitment period. That second commit period was framed so that it would be a 25 to 40% reduction in emissions from the Kyoto Protocol parties below their 1990 levels. 25 to 40% reduction. Actually, where's your computer? You're welcome to borrow mine if you need to.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. 25 to 40% reduction below 1990 levels by the parties to the Kyoto Protocol. So essentially an extension and deepening of the commitment by the Annex I parties to reduce emissions. It also provided an explicit and express framework for parties who had engaged in flexibility mechanisms during the first commitment period to maintain and keep their credits during the second commitment period. So all those discussions we've had about the Clean Development Mechanism, the Joint Implementation, the European Trading System, carbon trading, billions of dollars of carbon assets maintained the marketability. That's a legal consequence number one, big impacts. Legal consequence number two, also a little bit beneath the surface, there was a framework set up for long-term cooperative action and the creation of what are called working groups. The working groups shifted a lot of the nuts and bolts arm wrestling over the terms of the agreement to smaller groups that hammered out frameworks and agreements over the period of years between the major meetings of the parties. So we'll be talking about some of those working groups, but one of them, for example, deals with the long-term consequences and adaptation discussions. There's also a separate one dealing specifically with the Doha principle platform, which we'll talk about in a minute. So you'll notice we're still working our way along a chronology here. So Bali, Copenhagen, Cancun, and Durban, and now Nick.
So Durban set up a second commitment period, so they basically just said there's going to be one, like this is when it's going to be, because it was like through 2020 or something, right?
Right. Remember, the Kyoto Protocol expired of its own terms in 2012. So what the Durban agreement did was essentially set up a framework to extend it starting 2013 to 2020. So it's just another 7-year gasp. The idea being that in 2015, we'll reach a new agreement, and under Durban, that new agreement takes effect in 2020. So it prevents having a gap.
Okay, I got you. So what Durban was, it was just basically extending Kyoto for the people that wanted to continue on.
Right. Okay. And we'll talk a little bit more about, and I think last class we talked a little bit more about the fact that there are significant parties that bailed out. And we can spend a little bit of time talking about why it was so important for some nations that some type of Kyoto extension was agreed to. So that brings us up to Doha 2012. I'm going to confess to you right now, we're not going to talk about Warsaw 2013. We're not going to talk about Lima 2014. There's just not enough that happened to justify us spending a lot of brain power on them. But Doha is the last significant meeting that resulted in changes of trajectory towards Paris. At this point, you're starting, to quote the dearly departed and much beloved Yogi Berra. Right? This should sound like deja vu all over again. You're going to sound familiar. One, from Doha, they confirmed the 2 degrees Celsius target. Notice that this has become an enormously important talisman for negotiations. It has several packaged policy and value judgments in it. And once we get through discussing Doha, we could talk a little bit about whether or not it's a good idea to have 2 degrees Celsius as our target. It did, however, say that it set a mechanism for what it called a more ambitious ratcheting down to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that more ambitious agreement framework is to be on the table specifically in Paris. So we may actually see the finish line moving away a little bit from our current efforts to make it more emissions requirements mandatory. Second, it confirmed mitigation along the Copenhagen commitments. Remember those 141 lodgings of exceedances that were done by the nations? Essentially, Doha turned those into actual official obligations is a too strong a word, recognized international commitments by each of those nations. Remember, a lot of those commitments were couched in conditional language. A lot of those commitments in terms of not emissions reductions, but other types of national mammoth approaches. But the bottom line is that it did sort of legitimize the Copenhagen pickup that took place after the meeting wrapped up. And Doha was the place where they formally agreed to extend Kyoto for the second commitment period. Before moving on, that might actually be the best point. It's interesting to note the parties pushing for the extension of the Kyoto second compliance period were not Europe. It was not Japan. It was not the parties that were actually signed up for the buying emissions. It was India and China. They made it a precondition for further negotiations in Doha moving forward towards Paris. So out of curiosity, I'm just speculation, why would it be so important to India and China that Kyoto still draw breath on the way to Paris? Why would they care? It's not their emissions that are going down.
First thought is CDMs.
They elaborate, sir.
Well, my brain just immediately went to all of the implementation, all these projects, all these programs we have, but I mean, we were just talking about that wind power in one of those northern provinces, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that there's, and then India and China are the significant percentage of those CDMs, and I'm sure that they want those investment to continue. They want prospective investors to, I guess, not pull out of whatever. So,
okay,
that's your answer.
So, explanation one potentially is crass financial self-interest, mm-hmm. but that's a legitimate one.
Sure.
Both nations are deeply dedicated to raising their populations out of poverty. Any other possible explanations? Additional. I'm not saying you're wrong, but just an addition.
I would agree with that completely, and they probably stand to gain from acquiring credits from countries that have credits to burn,
mm-hmm.
because they are currently creating emissions.
So not only investment in projects, but also straight up cash on the table for the credits that they're getting paid for.
Because Kyoto keeps the two tracks, and they don't want, because if the two tracks go away, India and China are going to have to do a lot more because they're at the very top of the developing nations. So they want to stay down with all the other developing countries.
Which is, Kyoto is a shield. It essentially gives a legitimate basis for China and India to say it is improper to ask them to reduce emissions. and that the Kyoto Protocol's two-tier approach is the proper legal expression of UNFCCC commitments. All true. Any others to throw out there? Now, and I'm not fishing. I think we've hit the main ones. So be creative here for a minute. Anything else you
thought? Small one is just burnishing their image. Also, just holding on to this idea of Kyoto. I mean, they don't want to be pariahs either at the same time. So I think that does give them a little bit, just especially for those who don't know that much about climate law or climate change agreements. It looks like they've done something, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, if I could take that and twist it a little, which I frequently do, it also, to a certain extent, kept the feet of the industrialized nations to the fire. To a certain extent, I think you're right in that they want to be seen as a good actor on climate. There's also, to a certain extent as well, a need for progress. They may genuinely believe we need to reduce the emissions. But I'll also add, to a certain extent, there's legitimate fear that if Kyoto collapsed, a lot of nations that are currently taking steps to concretely reduce emissions just could walk away. Keeping Kyoto in effect essentially perpetuates their stake in the game.
Keeps the band together.
Exactly. That's a good rock band analogy, I have to remember that. So anyway, Kyoto had a lot of reasons to persist, although, as I've mentioned before, several important parties opted out. Canada no longer participates. Japan no longer participates, Russia no longer participates. And as a result, to a certain extent, the parties who are now committed to the second commitment period are only 15% of greenhouse gas emissions in the world today. So, you know, to a little bit, I tend to think of it affectionately as a zombie accord. It stumbles on, shuffles down the street, but it doesn't have anywhere near the same impact it used to. But it's important as a bridge. So, that's one very important keystone aspect of Doha. It made that real. It implemented that. In addition, other takeaways from Doha, and I'm mentioning these because they will be relevant to you next Tuesday when we start talking about what Paris needs to include. It specifically included new guidelines for adaptation. Remember those Bali principles? The first one was adaptation. What Doha did was essentially say that there are specific guidelines that parties must comply with under what's called the Cancun Adaptation Framework, and defines what exactly a National Action Plan is versus a National Action Program of Action. A NAP versus a NAPA. It is unbelievable. You know, short of Hazardous Waste Law and Clean Air Act law, there are more acronyms in the climate change law than almost any field. Bottom line is that national action plans are basically the big picture. Everybody does them. They sort of spell out the arc of climate justice for each nation and what they're going to do to adapt. NAPA's action programs of action are the nuts and bolts implementation on a short-term basis. All parties have both NAPs and NAPAs. But in particular, all the developed nations agreed to help the lesser developed nations, the LDCs, develop their own NAPAs because they just don't have identical resources. Others will sound familiar to you. The technology transfer provisions in Doha were also extended, and there was specific commitments made for a working group and secretariat to assist with technology transfer to lesser developed nations. Some questions as to who exactly is entitled to it, whether it's particularly vulnerable nations or lesser developed nations. It's a technicality, but it just determines who gets to get the money and the technical resources. And finance. I'm sure it will shock many of you to find that by the time Doha rolled around, nobody had committed any money to either the $30 billion commitment or the $100 billion commitment. And that was creating a great deal of friction and questions about the ultimate durability and credibility of the Copenhagen process or the Cancun commitments. So essentially, much negotiation led to now a $10 billion commitment to the fund. That's the current topping of the tank. I'm sure the distribution of who made those commitments will not surprise you, I hope. The most funds are coming from I'll pause here. Which nation is most likely to give the most money for climate change, green climate fund for helping other nations? Sorry?
Norway.
Norway?
I just like
us, the United States. One of those things that the United States tends not to get much credit for, and the ability to get it through the Senate has been vigorously questioned. But the bottom line is right now, of that $10 billion, $3 billion is coming from the United States. The next one up is a little over $1 billion from the UK. France is putting up a little less than $1 billion. Japan's also putting a significant amount of money in. Between those nations, that's probably close to 85% of the commitments to the fund. And right now, the ambition is to try and leverage it with private contributions and matching contributions and economic development contributions so that we'll ultimately reach $100 billion by the time that we get out of Paris or the full accord is implemented in 2020. So those are the big ones, you know, adaptation, technology transfer, financing, and to a certain extent, some discussion as well about the goals and the commitment for the Kyoto secondary commitment period. Let me now point to the one the lawyers are all interested in. And the book talks about this a little bit, but there is a separate work group for what's called loss and damages. This is a different beast. And this is one I'm actually hoping we'll have some folks flying in all over the world in January here to U of H to talk about. Loss and damage is focused on the idea that there are what we'll call slow burn climate change damages. Instead of a storm, instead of an adaptation to a sudden event, you can have a very incremental creep that causes damage that adaptation really doesn't address. A change in salinity over a period of decades may wipe out a coastal estuary. That's not something adaptation captures. Adaptation is building things like a resilient coastal framework for port systems or building a seawall to prevent against surges. But things that you can't really adapt to in that sort of way, how do you deal with nations that suffer significant damages due to that? So loss and damages essentially is looking at the bigger question of who's entitled to get compensation for deep rooted climate damages that you can't adapt to. And think about what might be falling into that category. We're talking about island nations disappearing under the waves. You can't adapt to that. We're talking about essentially long-term destabilization of low-lying coastal nations that rely on saltwater estuaries or other types of agricultural techniques that will become unviable. We're talking about large sub-Saharan economies that rely on water supplies or upper Himalayan water communities that are basically relying on water that will no longer exist. So the LDA work group essentially is designed to figure out a metric on figuring who is entitled to cash for that type of long-term damage, and more importantly, who is going to pay that cash. So it has become a subtext for liability. It's where you will find the most vigorous objections and the most minute and technical points. The entire Warsaw discussion, which I promised to save you from having to learn, nearly collapsed over this one work group's issue. So, short answer is Doha only set up a framework for discussing these issues with a trajectory towards having a proposal on how to deal with them in Paris. That work group had a meeting in Bonn last week. They've had their preliminary results produced for discussion, but at this point, it does not look like they're going to take any controversial steps of setting up a liability principle or specifying exactly who's entitled to how much for particular. But it's more of a that sort of incremental, here's how we'll keep talking about it, here's how we'll try and reach accord, here's how we'll start setting time frames for when we're going to reach that accord. But in the meantime, we're not going to talk at all about what the content of that accord is going to be. But for those of who are looking at long-term climate liability litigation, the LDA is where the action is likely to be. So I'll pause now. That gets us through decades of climate negotiation And I'm sorry that you guys have had a litigation baton march here, but I wanted to make sure you had all the vocabulary before we start playing with this stuff. So just remember the key ones. We're talking about UNFCC, we're talking about Kyoto, we're talking about Bali, we're talking about Cancun, we're talking about Durban, we're talking about Doha. Those are the key, you'll notice all those conferences of parties have agreements and all of them sort of stitch together and arc towards a framework that is going to culminate, at the risk of sounding like the people before Copenhagen, will culminate in Paris. So unless there are questions you guys have about any of those agreements and how they stitch together, or things from the book that you might want to delve into more deeply, I would like to sort of take the irrevocable next step. I give, as of, thank you, Ivan, June, the current state of the negotiation text. It's on the website, too. You'd rather not have the paper. But from my perspective, I find sometimes having the tactile experience of having the paper in front of you and leafing through it helps fix things in your mind. We are not going to read all 85 pages here today. What I'd like for you to do, though, is actually take it, feel it, ripple through, and have it in your hands when we start talking about what's coming up next. In particular, look through this and see if you can flag which parts of these deal with those four foundational principles from the Bali Action Plan. Where's the adaptation framework discussion? Where are we looking at technology transfer? Where's the finance discussion? And where's capacity building? In addition as well, buried in here, look for the long-term damage discussions. And what I'd like you to do is, to a certain extent, have this in your pocket when we start talking about what Paris is likely to result in. So, if I could, let me set the stage for Paris a little bit. Here's the depressing news. In anticipation of Paris, as part of the ongoing framework established the UNFCC, as well as the Doha commitments, every nation has been submitting their national commitments on what they're going to be doing to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And the bottom line is that if you add all those national commitments up, as of last Thursday, the total amount of reductions accomplished will keep our, we will still see a temperature increase in the planet up to 3.5 degrees centigrade. That is actually 6.3 degrees Fahrenheit. That is an enormous jump. The actual business as usual forecast, if you just did nothing and just let things emissions go as they would otherwise, 4.5 degrees centigrade. So there's some reduction, but nowhere near the 2 degrees threshold. So there's more to be done. So here are the questions on the table for Paris. One, do we need a binding treaty? Or instead, do we keep with our bottom-up, nudge-along approach? And if we do that, what should that approach be? Right now, the directions from the Doha platform, as well as the work group from the on the Durban platform, which was set up, say that the parties are going to get, quote, a protocol, another legal instrument, or agreed outcome with legal force under the convention, applicable to all parties, close quote. That one's worth typing out. It's looking at it closely. There's a lot of subtleties packaged in there. You'll notice that in an almost throwaway, they've discarded the two-track system. The treaty will be applicable to all parties. You'll also note that it is saying that it has an agreed outcome of legal force. It doesn't say treaty. It doesn't say convention. So there's flexibility built into the projected goal that allows the use of something that has legal bite that's short of a treaty that requires ratification. Again, very carefully negotiated language. So what are we shooting for? That's question number one. Number two, to what extent will this negotiation allow the use of domestic law in shaping ultimate international commitments? And, well, I'd like to flag that one because that's going to be a nice segue for us when we transition to U.S. climate change law next week. Third, when we talk about adaptation, how is Paris going to deal with all those lesser developed nations, developing nations, that do not fall into that category of particularly vulnerable to climate change, or less developed nation, which is essentially the poorest of the poor? For example, what should Paris do about Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia is, in a way, particularly vulnerable to climate change. That vulnerability is economic, and that vulnerability arises from whether or not the weaning off of fossil fuels affects their national economy. We'll talk about this a little bit, but the bottom line is Saudi Arabia thinks they're entitled to compensation, which is not a concept that goes down well here in the United States. And last, what's common but differentiated responsibility in an era where China emits more greenhouse gases than the United States, and when developing nations collectively emit more greenhouse gases than the developed world? And if we're going to rethink common but differentiated, what's the replacement concept? Are we going to talk about essentially climate equity? Are we going to talk about historical accountability? Are we going to talk about carbon lock-in and being able to essentially divide up a shrinking carbon pie for allowable emissions going forward into the future? So those are all on the table. What I'd like to do right now, since we've got a few minutes, is talk about some of those in more detail. Number one, let's talk about whether we need a treaty, and let's talk about the United States' perspective. Remember right now, and this sort of perhaps sort of get everyone re-engaged, what treaties has the United States signed related relevant to climate change? That's one. Any others?
What's she saying?
UNFCCC.
She said very quietly, UNFCCC.
Sorry, Kyoto. Okay.
There you go. We signed it. We didn't ratify it. It was very carefully answered. Very good. Any others?
Montreal.
Which is a protocol to?
The UNFCCC.
No, close. There's a Vienna Convention, which set the framework for the Montreal Accord. So in a way, it's like
Vienna.
UNFCCC Kyoto. What?
We signed Vienna.
We signed the Montreal Protocol. So we're a member for both of those. To a certain extent, we already are a climate change player. So that's it. That basically means we have not had a climate ratification treaty since H.W. Bush.
Which one did we actually ratify?
The UNFCCC.
Okay.
And also the Montreal Protocol, both under George H.W. Bush. Not to talk politics, I'll simply say I think it's an objective matter. He probably is the president who gets the least credit for accomplishing things during his tenure than almost any presidency since LBJ. He did a lot of amazing things in the environmental world. So having said that, if I'm going to lay a predicate, which I hope no one else agrees with me, but feel free to if you want. The prospect of getting a treaty in the United States ratified is nil. Anyone want to challenge that? All right. So we are, from the United States perspective, presented with a challenging task. Yes, Ivan?
How long do we get to ratify a treaty?
Interesting question. The treaty oftentimes itself sets a deadline when parties must ratify and deposit their instruments of ratification. That time frame varies, but typically it tends to be between 3 to 5 years. It might happen if we have another Democratic president elected and a transition of power in Congress of both houses sufficient to override a veto and also to get a two-thirds majority in the Senate for ratification purposes. So theoretically it's possible. That fine bottle of wine bet maybe need to be extended for that particular possibility though. So let me lay out for the table. Remember back our discussion of the principles of international law and how they interface with U.S. law. Are there any other tools on the table we can use besides a straight-up treaty that the United States could put on the table legitimately?
We discuss executive orders.
Well, how would that work? It's a great idea. And I forgot to bring with me, but I will tell you there's some people at the Heritage Institute who are deeply, deeply suspicious that's exactly what's cooking right now. And they're threatening legal action. But how would an executive order work in this case?
In what context are we talking about? What was the question?
Well, the question is, we go to Paris as the United States. We're negotiating, knowing that we'll never have a high prospect of the Senate signing on to any treaty that requires a binding emissions limitation in the United States.
Okay, I think an easy answer to that would be an executive order which mandates that our domestic EPA would follow whatever agreements we make at Paris as far as binding restrictions on certain, whatever the bundle of greenhouse gases would be. That's
so,
right there.
Sign, not ratify the treaty, if there is one in Paris?
Oh, I mean, that's completely separate. I'd love if we sign the treaty, but I mean,
well, I just, because that would send, would that lay a predicate then for the executive order?
Absolutely. I think that would justify and strengthen the executive order.
Okay.
But we know the Heritage Foundation and others are going to go after the executive order regardless, so if it happens.
Let's set aside the entire secondary but delightful question of who can sue over executive orders. You know, standing on that one is going to be really interesting. But what would the executive order simply say, EPA shall do whatever it takes to meet the limits set out by the Paris Accord or Paris Treaty? Maybe a Paris Accords, actually, under the UNFCCC.
Well, I guess my answer is cautiously yes, why not?
Okay. Legally, is there any reason, if someone in the Senate objected to that approach, that would say that might be functionally the same as signing a treaty?
Sure.
I'm not trying to lead you off a cliff.
Well, and I'm trying to think about like all the different...
Well, you're on Senator Inhofe's staff. What would your argument be to Senator Inhofe why this is an illegal collusion between the internationalist and the Trilateral Commission and the Obama Socialist Administration?
Oh, because the Senate's responsible for signing treaties. The President's only responsible for foreign policy. This is overstepping the boundaries of the President's power, and then we can get into all the, what is the constitutional question of, is in the twilight of his power, or whatever the language is.
Of the Robert Jackson language?
Yeah.
And the Steele cases?
Uh-huh.
All true. Let's sort of then say, doesn't that then turn on the predicate, what is a treaty?
Or is it a convention? So then we get into this magical language of shadow treaties and whatnot.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So option one, say, we don't need your stinking treaty, but I'll sign this executive order that says we'll do everything a treaty says anyway. Okay. Any other options on the table? Essentially, that's whole hog, but we're just going to do it without signing anything.
Are we assuming that it's going to be a treaty? Assuming that's what they're going to call it in Paris and that's what it's going to be?
Well, that's what the Durban platform calls for. So
okay.
It doesn't call for a treaty, though, remember? That's a very good question. Remember,
what if it's not called a treaty? Then you could maybe backdoor around it with an executive order and say it's not actually a treaty.
I mean, if you'll indulge me, the precise language was, quote, a protocol, another legal instrument, or agreed outcome with legal force under the convention applicable to all parties. So, protocol like the Kyoto Protocol, essentially an additional treaty, additional agreement to a prior agreement. The U.S. Department of State's legal advisor has typically taken the position that a protocol is a functionally effective the same as a treaty.
Okay.
It still requires concurrence of two-thirds of the Senate. But what does another legal instrument or agreed outcome of legal force mean? And by the way, that's an open-ended question because no one knows. But if you're at the United States, if you're thinking about it from a creative perspective, maybe an executive order or maybe even something paired with an international commitment that is not embodied in the form of an actual protocol or treaty would satisfy this obligation without actually having to sign and ratify something. Any other ideas to throw out, Ivan?
What about declaring certain things common heritage?
Oh.
Or if you declare that the Arctic is common heritage, there's an international duty to not let it then the U.S. would be bound to abide by that.
Well, are you thinking in terms of customary law?
Something like a mixture of the two.
Okay. So essentially, the White House issues a proclamation or a presidential statement that it is the position of the United States through the exercise of the president's unitary foreign affairs power under the Constitution that the United States will accede to the principle that the atmosphere is a common heritage of mankind, and therefore all sovereign nations, including the United States, are subject to limitations in their ability to impair or exploit that common heritage. And period, subtext, we now hereby wave our wand, and this is now customary international law binding on us and future administrations. And it sounds like you think that the actual proclamation itself is a legal document with some type of consequence.
Well, I think you said if you start following, you can't stop, right? If enough people are following it, even if you're late to the game, you have to abide by it as well.
All right. Well, again, with my usual caveat, Professor Paust is always right if I disagree with him. You can object to the creation of a customary international norm that's applicable to your sovereign activities through consistent and express actions that demonstrate that there is no opinio juris that you accede to. Once you do agree to it, you can't say, oops, I take it back 5 years later. What you have to do is say, we renounce that norm, but in doing so, that is an act of violation of the norm, and you incur liability as a sovereign nation under international law for that. So once you cross the Rubicon, it becomes a principle. Now, having said that, a nation can always violate a customary international norm. That's part of their sovereign powers. The question is, what liability can you invoke, and can you enforce that liability? Suppose the United States does what you say, Ivan, and we end up creating a customary international norm that there's a common heritage, essentially trust in the atmosphere. And we just say 5 years later, when President Cruz is elected, you know, the hell with that.
Don't scare me like that. My heart stopped.
I think there's Cruz, you mean, right? Yeah, I think I heard some involuntary noises around the table.
I mean, it might be Trump.
Yeah. He says, to hell with it. Oh, Lord, now you're making me.
It's going to build a fence around the atmosphere.
Can you privatize the atmosphere? That'd be the interesting. Oh, anyway, if they walk away, if the United States walks away from that commitment after the norm's been established, and you're the Netherlands, to pick a convenient country, how do you hold the United States accountable? All right, so what can the EU do to the United States?
Sanctions.
Sanctions. You could do United Nations sanctions. Of course, the United Nations is subject to a veto by the United States, so it's unlikely that's going to happen.
But it's true with the European Union.
The European Union can impose their own sanctions in terms of trade sanctions. Unfortunately, under GATT, there are limits on what they can do, and it's going to trigger retaliatory sanctions, probably, for the United States.
Or a 15-year lawsuit in the WTO.
But are you thinking of canned tuna by, or dolphins and canned tuna by any chance?
Or? Oh, yeah, there's a couple examples. Yeah. And steel and chicken wings. And
yeah, it's an entirely interesting and arcane world. Bottom line is, once you create the customary international norm, the United States can still violate it. There's a risk of liability. The collection and enforcing that liability is difficult and problematic, is my suggestion. And
that's true.
I don't deny it exists. It's important, but
wouldn't it be difficult for the U.S. to get out of it anyways, from just internal pressure?
From whom?
The constituents, I suppose.
I'm generally suggesting to my hypothetical that internal pressure is not likely to deter President Cruz or a continuingly Republican-dominated Congress. But you're right. It's entirely possible. Maybe there'll be another weather disaster that will mobilize opinion. We don't know. But I'm simply suggesting that customary international norms tend to be a soft legal obligation that requires coordinated international action to enforce. It's difficult. as opposed to a treaty or a protocol, which spells out in black and white typically what the enforcement obligations are, what happens if you violate them, and what the sanctions might be. So, but I like your idea. It's sort of a nice way to kind of ratchet the pressure. It does have legal consequence. Any others before I sort of throw out the one the Heritage Foundation is so paranoid about? All right, because it's actually a blend of what you guys have been talking about. I will distribute this position paper if you promise never to distribute it further and not to ever imply I'm endorsing this position. But the position is this. They are concerned that the Obama administration is going to basically pick and choose. They're going to sign for portions of the Paris Accords that come out, or Paris Protocols, that involve monitoring, annual reporting, national commitments on emission reductions, all things that we have already agreed to under the ratified UNFCCC. And that, therefore, there is no need for subsequent re-ratification of that obligation. So if Paris basically puts teeth or expands or otherwise operationalizes those obligations, we do it with a stroke of a pen. We're done. For anything beyond that core UNFCCC concepts that are already ratified, that's where an executive order comes in. And to a certain extent, the argument is that the president has the ability, especially if we sign but do not ratify the Paris Accords, sorry, I keep misstating that, the Paris Protocols, that executive order has the ability to exercise the president's unilateral foreign affairs power in a way that the Senate cannot object to its lack of a ratification. So by basically not trying to do the whole enchilada through executive order, you save that executive order for the portion which cannot be arguably under the UNFCCC. And once that executive order is in place, particularly if they sign but do not submit for ratification, there's enough for international legal obligations, along, I would suggest, of custom international law, to create a soft norm going forward. Now, this is not a legal point, but I'll simply say that smacks a bit of conspiracy theory thinking. It's very creative, but it seems not perhaps terribly possible. But nonetheless, from a legal perspective, it highlights a possibility that given the flexibility of the language from Doha, that it doesn't have to just be a treaty or protocol, there's an array of different tools on the table that nations can choose to agree on what they're going to do. And that's a way of saying, you guys have a lot of creativity for what's coming up next. For next Tuesday, I would like to have us demonstrate our understanding of the trajectory of the climate change legal agreements and what's on the table of Paris by having you guys actually think through and argue for positions of particular members of the Conference of Parties. So from that perspective, oh, first of all, most importantly, here's the attendance sheet I forgot to distribute.
And we have meetings in separate rooms for this?
I'm going to do better than that. First of all, I have a list of 10 nations. So each of you, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, we actually may be extra nation here, so we may have to sacrifice one of them.
We're missing one. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Ronnie's not here. Okay, so Ronnie gets whoever everyone else doesn't want. So these are the major players at the conference coming up. I'm going to ask people to volunteer for which one they would like, and if we find nations that are orphans that no one will take, I'll point a finger at whoever happens to be sitting closest to me. So who would like to be Australia?
Do we have to follow Australia?
Caroline.
Do we need to follow their actual views?
Hang in there. We'll get there. Brazil. Oh, all right. That could be interesting. China. All right. Ivan is China. I have one just as good. India. You sure?
I'll try it.
You may be an unpopular guy by the end of the day. Russia. Melba takes Russia. Here's a fun one. Saudi Arabia. You sure? I thought for that was one that Ronnie was definitely going to get. South Africa. You sure, Hannah? Have you ever been to South Africa?
No.
Actually, if you want to, you can talk with Professor Kumar. She's there as we speak. She's in Cape Town. She just gave a presentation there yesterday. All right, let's go ahead and get this out of the way. Who wants to be the United States? Since you worked for the United States over the summer, you kind of feel obligated to do this. All right. He's just giving you a hard time because he's representing that international rogue Brazil. All right. That leaves the last one, Tuvalu. Who hasn't volunteered yet? Tuvalu. Tuvalu is a beautiful island nation in the deep South Pacific that is forecast not to exist in 50 years. They are actually in the middle of a very interesting process of working with Yale and recruiting other law schools to file a claim in the International Court of Justice, claiming that their sovereign right to exist as a nation is being damaged by other nations and that they're going to sue them, which should be an interesting idea. So what did Ronnie end up with? Did I miscount? Okay, here's, I'm going to offer Ivan and Spencer the choice. Since you guys are the two biggest players, you can have an additional delegate if you so choose. Would either of you like to have a number two, or would you like to sort of do it by yourself?
Sure.
All right. Sorry, Ivan, he said it like a half second before you. All right, so you get Ronnie.
We object to that.
See, you're already getting to the spirit. Okay. Here's what we got. This is just a sort of fact sheet to encapsulate some of the thinking. Here, let me grab, keep one of those for not too many. On the background, everyone's going to share dealing with what's on the plate for Paris. Now, let's see. If you pass this down to Caroline, you get Brazil. Pass this down to Ivan, China. Sorry, India. Goes to Joey. Melba's Russia. Let's see, Saudi Arabia goes down. Who? Hannah, you had South Africa. Okay, would you take that down, or just pass down to Hannah? All right, and then let's see. That wasn't smart. For Tuvalu, I wrote Tuvalu. Sorry, Albert. Okay, you pass that to Albert. And that's for Spencer. Okay, the reason I'm giving you all these now is to give you a chance to look, digest, and think about over the weekend, but also I'm going to circulate the contact list. So if you guys want to, you can contact each other, make side agreements, have done separate negotiations prior. But on Tuesday of next week, what I'd like to do is essentially sit down and invoke a convention of the parties. I am passing around a draft resolution as a starting point for us to start thinking about. The key thing here is I want each of you to have essentially distilled down, and let's just say within 5 minutes or less, your top 5 points, at most 7. So that if you are trying to persuade a deeply skeptical delegate from another nation, your hardest hitting points, the things you think matter most that you want to walk away from this agreement with.
So there are things you want out of the agreement?
Things that you believe are most vital to your nation and things that you want, think the agreement must reflect as a result. And frankly, if we end up not reaching an agreement, that may be totally realistic. There's no assurance here of success. Alternatively as well, if everybody comes in and you're done within 10 minutes, I'll deeply suspect collusion has taken place. It should be hard. But the idea here, I think, is I want to see if we can essentially, in a lab-type setting, see what agreements you guys can reach that will forecast what's actually going to happen in Paris. Because unfortunately, Paris is going to take place the week after we wrap up our class. And I tried and almost got funding to take some of you with me to Paris for the negotiations, until someone pointed out that the school would not let me take students to Paris during finals exam period. So I'm sorry. It's deeply frustrating because I'm talking with other law professors who are taking their classes to Paris, which is next time. Sorry.
Yeah. During our mock negotiations, will we be able to break into smaller groups and talk
I will be the chair, but I will not be controlling. All I'm going to ask is that we have an initial opening discussion where each of you will just lay out what you want the others to hear. By the way, if you have your 5 points and you have one you think it would accomplish your goals not to disclose it, I'm fine with that. But realize that you may lack the ability to persuade people if you hide your agenda from them. And then if you want to break, if you want to have open discussion, if you want to do an open markup, I'll have the draft of the resolution so you can actually do it on the screen if that's what you prefer. The key thing is I want to be able to walk out of here seeing where agreement is likely to be and what we can try and accomplish. And have some fun doing it. So if you have questions, if you have thoughts about it, email me. I'll answer in a way so that the whole class sees the answer unless you ask me otherwise. Other than that, come in on Tuesday refreshed and ready to battle for your nation's sovereign rights. Okay? And this should be fun. All right, with that, I am done unless you have anything else you want to ask about or questions about the international framework. This is sort of your last chance because on Thursday next week, we start working our way through U.S. climate change law. And there is a lot going on right now. It's a good time to be studying this. Okay, enjoy this spectacularly beautiful weekend.